Welcome to Reboot Republic, Ireland's politics and social change podcast, where we talk to the leading change makers about the big issues and, most importantly, solutions. This is the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and joined, as always, by my alter ego, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you?
I'm good, buddy. I'm good. Summer has arrived.
It has indeed. And indeed, it's a summer on the podcast for me today because we are joined by the incredible Professor Richard Wilkinson, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Nottingham Medical School, an honorary professor at the University College London and the University of York. And Richard, along with Kate Pickett, is the author of the book The Spirit Level, which deals with inequality in societies and was chosen as one of the top 10 books of the decade by the New Statesman. And he, along with Kate, is also the author of a new book called The Inner Level, which looks at how more equal societies reduce stress, restore sanity, and improve everyone's well-being. Richard, thanks you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Well, it's nice to be invited. Thank you.
Richard, just to start with, maybe you could talk a bit about kind of the core idea within The Inner Level and kind of what you found from your research in terms of inequality and our societies and its impact.
Yes, in The Spirit Level, we looked at income inequality in a number of different rich societies. Basically, the income gap between rich and poor in each society. And we then showed that that was related to all sorts of health and social problems. Basically, the bigger the income gap, the more unequal a society, the worse its health is, the more violence there is, the more people in prison, the worse kids do in the international maths and literacy tests, the more drug abuse. Basically, all the problems which have what we call social gradients, the problems that become more common at the bottom of the social ladder, get worse when inequality increases. In a way, that's very obvious. I mean, saying only that the problems we know have social gradients, the problems we know are responsive to social status, get worse when social status differences increase. The only surprise is they don't just get worse amongst the poor. They get worse amongst the vast majority of the population. The biggest effects are on the poor, but even people with good education, good incomes, good jobs, and so on, if we move them to a more equal country, they'd probably live a bit longer. They'd be less likely to become victims of violence. Their children might do a bit better at school and be less likely to become seriously involved in drugs. In that sort of way, we all do better.
Mm. And you looked at kind of some of the areas in terms of inequality and, you know, this idea that kind of inequality creates its own impacts. It's not just about poverty. It's actually this idea of the gap between, you know, those at the top and those at the bottom creates all these anxieties. And you particularly talk about like status anxiety and how it creates and you. In that you talked about it in the spirit level, but then you developed that further in the latest book in The Inner Level, isn't that right?
Yes, you see, nearly all the problems that you showed in The Spirit Level are more common in more unequal societies are behavioral, you know, that there's more violence, more drug abuse, so on. And that tells us that somehow inequality gets into our heads. It makes us behave differently. And so we, in our next book, The Inner Level, we were really trying to explore that. And it looks as if what income inequality does is to make social status, social class more important. It increases the idea that some people are much more important than others, worth much more than others, if you like. It makes us judge each other, value each other more by status. So, you know, we all use external wealth as if it was a marker or measure of internal or personal worth. And, of course, as we judge each other like that and worry more about how we are judged, It undermines our own feelings of self-worth. And there are now studies that show that the more inequality there is in a society, the more anxiety people have about status and how they're judged by others. And again, that's not just in the top income groups. Sorry, it's not just in the lowest income groups. It's right across all income groups. Everyone becomes more worried about status. And that feeds into a number of mental illnesses and personality disorders and so on.
Yeah. And you, it's interesting how you came at this. Like, you're an epidemiologist, or as you, I think you describe yourselves, as a social epidemiologist. Is that correct?
Yes. Epidemiology is really the subject which looks at health, not in individual patients or in laboratories, but in the population. Mm. So epidemiologists traditionally look at statistical relationships to see whether people who get this or that kind of cancer are more exposed to some occupational chemical, or, you know, making those links between exposures and disease, exposures in everyday life. Social epidemiologists are really people who came into an epidemiology from outside medicine.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the methods are basically statistics.
Yeah.
And you can see that when you're looking at social and economic factors in relation to health, that you can very easily use those same techniques to look at endless other health and social problems.
It's interesting you come at this from a health perspective, because a lot of kind of inequality analysis is around, you know, economics, and obviously you're an economist yourself. But it was an interesting idea, and I think quite profound, and you actually explain it brilliantly in your TED Talk, which, of course, you're probably well aware, has 3 million views, your TED Talk from 2011, like incredible numbers. But you explained that this idea that, you know, we've got developed societies, you know, this huge economic growth. But what you found was that economic growth or economic development didn't determine people's, like, well-being, health outcomes, wasn't the key determinant anymore. It was actually the level of inequality. And I thought that was quite a profound finding, and has, you know, should have major impacts for economics, for how we assess our societies in terms of measuring, you know, we measure our development by economic growth. Whereas you're saying, hang on a minute, not that shouldn't be the key measure anymore. We need to look at things that determine inequality and tells us how unequal our societies are.
Yes, if you look at rich and poor societies together, as societies get richer, there are very big improvements in all sorts of outcomes to do with health and well-being and education and everything else. But when you look, and that, all that improvement happens in the fairly early stages of economic growth, and then it levels out. So the rich countries have got beyond the point where economic growth makes much difference to measures of well-being. Growth is what's really transformed the quality of our lives, but in a sense, it's finished its work. You could say, I suppose, that for countries and people who haven't got basic necessities, growth is very important. But having more and more of everything makes less and less difference. And that's our situation in the rich world. However, because we started off studying health inequalities, the huge social class differences in death rates and in endless different diseases, in life expectancy and so on, it became clear that those health inequalities are not just a matter of the different material circumstances in which we live and the quality of our diets and so on. They are also affected by social status itself. So where you are in the pecking order seems to be itself a stressor affecting all sorts of physiological functioning, and more stress, lower status, making you more vulnerable to a wide range of diseases. And as soon as we'd made those links that we were dealing with something that had a very powerful psychosocial component, then of course it would be silly to think that that only influenced health and death rates. You'd expect higher levels of stress and anxiety to influence all sorts of other outcomes, and that's of course what we've shown.
We have seen in Ireland, obviously, the Celtic Tiger crash, the period of austerity, one of the biggest economic collapses in recent economic history globally. You know, what is it, 64 billion of bank debt lumbered on a tiny population. And what we've seen as a result of that is a lot of loss of social mobility, a lot of loss of identity, where you had people who, you know, young people who identified themselves as whatever their trade was, whether it was in construction, and the loss of self. And then on the back of that, we had austerity politics, which peeled back mental health supports. Instead of supporting these people, we saw, you know, situations where we can tell stories anecdotally, and I don't want to necessarily point anything, but we also have a problem now where we're trying to reemerge now, where the economy is again booming, but the trauma of that loss of identity, that loss of self, and that loss of what we meant as a community, that hasn't been repaired at all. And unfortunately, our current Taoiseach has used phrases like that. He doesn't recognise class as an issue. He has said things like that. Do we find that the politics of austerity has caused this trauma to be borne out even longer than it needed to be?
I think it's clear that austerity in countries where it's been pretty savage, that you've experienced and were experiencing in Britain, and similar problems in the United States, that it is causing a rise in death rates in the United States. It was first apparent amongst poorer, white, middle-aged people, where death rates suddenly started going up, and going up as a result of drugs, suicide, and alcohol principally. And those people were often the people living in the areas of the states that got left behind. In Britain now, we're seeing a rise in death rates, which started with older people, really old, 18 plus, and also in infant mortality, particularly amongst poorer in poorer families. And so what you're seeing in Britain is the, if you like, the effect of the cutting of services on the people who are most vulnerable, who most needed those services. And so our life expectancy, which has risen almost continuously for 150 years or something, has now leveled off. In the last few years, it hasn't risen at all. And that's really a major change. I haven't looked at the Irish figures, but
very hard to find.
The crash were very fundamental and affected people's security in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, well, it did in terms of the... In Ireland, the levels of deprivation and poverty, particularly child poverty, reaches child deprivation reached at the high point 2013-14. A third of children were affected by deprivation. Now, since then, the figures have come back down again, but still our poverty rates are twice what they were before the crash. And as I think Tony's right to talk about, you know, we're almost in a post-austerity situation now. We've returned to economic growth. But the legacy of that period of austerity and kind of reinforced inequalities that pre-existed, like even during the boom, when inequalities were there, that we're seeing, you know, there has to be a huge impact on children, for example, and child development. And those inequalities, you know, in terms of children, we're seeing now, for example, homelessness, a major problem here. We have almost 4,000 children homeless, huge housing insecurity, a major housing crisis. And I read a really interesting paper in the Journal of Epidemiology, I think it was, on the impact of housing insecurity on people in the private rental sector and how it led to an increase in the biomarkers of stress. And this idea that, you know, again, we've economic growth, but we have this housing crisis where these groups, low, middle-income groups in the private rental sector, experiencing huge stress over insecurity, and how that must impact on them.
Yes, I think it's clear that particularly stresses in early life cast a long shadow forwards, that they will affect people years later. There's even a paper, actually, that says your exposure to inequality in childhood affects health in later life, you know, when you get to middle age and beyond. There are lots of different pathways. I mean, with more inequality, you get a rise in bullying in schools. Mm. There are huge differences in the prevalence of bullying between more and less equal countries. And bullying, too, has a long-term effect on people's welfare. If you've been bullied a lot, it really takes away your confidence. You can see the effects of that into adult life. But the other thing, of course, is that social mobility declines with inequality. There are now a number of studies which measure social mobility by comparing parents and children's incomes. It's mainly fathers and sons' incomes, because there are such big changes in women's economic activity rates that it's difficult to compare mothers' and daughters' incomes.
Yeah.
So in a way, these studies are asking, do rich fathers have rich sons and poor fathers have poor sons, or doesn't parental income matter very much to how you do? And what you see is, in more unequal societies, parental income is much more important in how you do in your life. I think people often think that somehow inequality, it might have these damaging social consequences, but maybe it's an important spur economically,
yes,
initiative and creativity. And yet the picture you get is that societies with great inequalities are wasting their talent, not only so lower social mobility, but also more children on drugs, more getting sent to prison, lower educational scores in terms of the maths and literacy tests and so on. It's not only wasting the talent in terms of thinking of people's ability as an economic resource, but the idea that inequality leads to more inventiveness and initiative. There are now studies looking at patents per head of population. You know, if you invent something, you might patent it. And actually, patents, too, are substantially lower in more unequal societies. So people are less creative.
Mm.
And we did a little study of that a while ago, but there's been a much bigger one more recently. And you can see patents per head of population lower in more unequal societies.
You raise a very interesting point on the... We've spoken to artists on this, poets and spoken word and writers, and they come in and they talk about the lack of... that because they're struggling, that there's an atomization and therefore creativity does decline. But there's also been, in Ireland in the last week, the CSO produced a report that showed... over 26% of households where 50%, more than 50% of the household income was some form of social transfer. So that's, you know, whether it's a rent allowance or a housing assistance payment or some additional state transfer to bring them out of that at risk of poverty. And we've also spoken to the head of the Fiscal Advisory Council in this room, and we've tried to say, well, how do we quantify the stress and the problems that we put on these families that are just about treading water and are actually dependent on that money from the state every week? Because they say, well, the state are doing great work in the heavy lifting these people out of poverty. But the reality is that if that means that they're only ever 1 week away from the wolf knocking on their door. And as a society, we don't really know how to measure that, I suppose.
I'm not sure I have. I agree with you. I think that's very true. And of course, governments tend to do no studies on the real cost of living a healthy life. Academics sometimes do that and criticize levels of benefits. They come way below what is necessary for a healthy life. And so increasingly societies have ideas of a living wage, which is substantially above the legal minimum wage. There have been big campaigns to get companies to pay that. In Britain, many of the big cities controlled by Labour local governments have set up what they call fairness commissions to think how to reduce income inequalities locally. And one of the things they've ended up doing, almost all of them, is to get the local government to pay the living wage, so that that's been a substantial rise in the incomes of cleaners and people at the bottom. There have also been campaigns in universities to get the universities to pay at least the living wage, sometimes combined with criticisms of the wages of the top, the vice chancellors and so on. I think it's a good thing for students to do as a campaign.
And just in terms of the like you were talking there about, you know, inequality and its impacts, but what about its causes? And, you know, because there's a lot of the narrative we hear about, you know, it's this individualization of the cause of poverty. And, you know, what do you see? We hear it a lot here as well. You know, it's people's fault, you know, the decisions they've made in their lives and poor decision making. And really this notion that, well, if you make the right decisions and if you work hard, well, you'll be able to, you know, get on okay. And those, you know, who are on benefits or whatever, it's their fault. What do you see in terms of your analysis of the causes? Do you think there's some legitimacy to those arguments, or what are the real causes of inequality?
I think there's a tendency on the conservative side of politics to think that the results of poverty, or the results of low social status, which I think is a better way of looking at it, like mental illness, drug abuse, homelessness, alcohol addiction, to think that those are the causes of poverty.
Yes.
We show again and again that those things that are, and if you're highly stressed, how do you deal with it? Of course you drink a bit more whenever you can afford to. The binge drinking that's more common lower down the social ladder. You know, I know when I drink a bit more or when I need to eat for comfort or whatever.
Yeah.
The same is true of drug use. A lot of it is a way of dealing with anxiety. I think that it's getting things the wrong way around to think that those are the causes of poverty or inequality. If you look at the really long-term trends in inequality, and over the whole of the 20th century, for instance, you find that the very high inequalities in the 1920s, and they start coming down sometime in the 1930s, and this is true of many different countries.
Yeah.
They go on coming down all the way until the late 1970s. And then from about 1980 onwards, they start going up again, dramatically up. And so the whole of the 20th century looks like a sort of U-shaped decline and then rise of inequality. And I think there's no doubt at all that that is a reflection, if you like, of the increasing power and influence of the labor movement, of social democratic parties, probably also increased fear of communism. And then at the end, from 1980s, with the rise of neoliberalism, the decline of trade union power, and the left, in a sense, losing any idea of its purpose, you get that rise in inequality. And actually, if you, as many people have now, I've seen this for half a dozen different countries, you add... You draw that line of the U-shaped change in inequality, and then you look at trade union membership, and it's exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
It's a mirror image of what happens to inequality. I don't think that's because the trade unions do enormous amounts for the wages of their members. I think they make a major difference, but I don't think they completely transform inequality. I think it's that trade union membership is a good marker of the strength of the, if you like, the labor movement, the if you like, the countervailing voice in society, people who believe that there's another way of doing things, there's another way society can work better for all of us. And when you get that reflected in, you know, all the television discussion things and newspaper columnists and so on, when you get, for instance, trade union leaders backed up by decent research departments, so they're well informed, who can put good arguments, but when all that dies away, the field, the ideology is left to neoliberals. And so you get anti-trade union legislation, you get privatization, you get reduction of top tax rates, wages at the top, CEOs' wages absolutely take off. There's a study which looks at the biggest, 300 or 400 companies in the United States. And it looks over time at the gap between the CEO's incomes at the top and the average production worker. And until the early 1980s, CEOs are earning 30 or 40 times as much as the average production worker. But when you get to the first decade of the present 21st century, you find that that gap has widened to 10 times as much as it was. They're getting 300 or 400 times as much as the average production worker. And, you know, it's the takeoff of those top incomes, people getting millions, paying themselves millions, which is where the rot sets in.
So what do you think then, you know, you've in your book outlined, kind of alternatives or recommendations that can kind of try and make societies more equal, the unequal ones, and... maybe before we get on to that, actually, I did want to talk to you about the difference between countries. Like, we have, you know, you show the graphs, countries like Japan, Sweden, Denmark, more equal. Maybe you could explain just briefly, you know, so that to see where, and I don't know how much you looked at Ireland to put it in context, but there are countries that are quite equal, and then there are countries which are much more unequal. So maybe give a sense of that.
When we were looking at this, writing the spirit level, we used figures that came from the UN Human Development Report, but they were the same then as the figures that the World Bank used. And we used the gap between the top and bottom 20% in each society. And we saw in the more equal countries, as you said, the Scandinavian countries and Japan, that the top 20% were getting 3.5 or 4 times as much as the bottom 20%. So that was the size of the gap. But when you look at the more unequal of the rich countries, like the United States, Britain, Portugal, you find the gap is twice as big. They're getting 7, 8, or even 9 times as much, the top 20%, as the bottom 20%. And it's, in a way, it's that that allows us to look and see what inequality does. We can really compare these societies, and there are really important differences between them. And the conclusion is absolutely clear that the more equal countries do so much better in terms of almost any measure of well-being.
Okay. The other question then was in terms of your recommendations you're making. You know, what, like a country like Ireland, which is considered, you know, middle of the ranking in terms of inequality, but you know, clearly we have a big issue, and Tony was alluding to that earlier in terms of this. In Ireland, we have actually one of the most unequal pre-distribution, pre-tax income levels in Europe, in the OECD. And I was going to ask you, actually, you know, we then have, in terms of post-tax, we're kind of mid-ranking then in terms of income distribution. So our Gini coefficient, our ranking of income inequality, is kind of mid-table.
A slap bang in the middle.
In the middle, because the state does this huge redistribution of welfare, as Tony mentioned, which is necessary and good because it does put us in a place at least where there is that mid-ranking of income inequality. But I wonder that, given that huge level of pre-tax income inequality, because that's the wages people take, there's a big gap between those at the top and those who are either unemployed or have very, you know, part-time jobs. Surely that must be causing a huge status anxiety and impact that isn't quantified in the Gini coefficient measure in Ireland. Do you think?
Well, and you can get Gini coefficients before and after redistribution. In all societies, nearly all societies, there is redistribution, and so the pre-tax income differences are bigger than the post-tax income differences. Some countries do a bit more redistribution than others, but nearly always there's an important difference between pre- and post-tax. I should say post-tax and benefits. It's the benefits that do most of the redistribution.
Yeah.
We use the post-tax and post-benefit incomes. I haven't seen studies which look and see whether one is more important for status than the others. But I would expect, what people have to spend would be the inequalities in that would be the most important, because I think the way huge income differences allow people to live in different areas of town, buy different, you know, cars and goods and so on, we're judging each other's status by those outward appearances, which are a reflection of expenditure. So I don't know whether ideas of status are also influenced by, pre-tax income. It does remind me, the journalist Polly Toynbee interviewed a number of bankers, the super rich, and she said, surely you can't spend all this money you're getting. And one of them said to her, no, but it shows me I'm better than the next man, which suggests maybe the gross income figure for some people is what counts.
Yeah, and that's, like, we have made a stab at it in Ireland. We do the standards and living condition report, and it will say, you know, how many times a week can someone have meat in their dinner? And this is the kind of the level, the unitary level that we're reduced to. And it does look at people as in terms of, sadly, that economic unitary model. And you mentioned the World Bank earlier as well, and how, you know, when you looked at those standards, how the biggest thing is that capitalism has lifted more people out of poverty in the last 100 years than any other model that we've ever had. But you also pointed out twice now that we've kind of tapped out. We've now seen that what people are referring to as a post-capitalist society, are we looking at zombie capitalism, or are we just looking at capitalism that has been recaptured in the last 10 years following austerity by the neoliberal agenda? I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I know, in terms of how we've got to deal both with inequality and climate change, I think those are the big issues in terms of, you know, whether capitalism can make these changes or not. I suppose I think that we are unlikely to be able to recreate the strength of the labor movement and the fear of communism and so on, which led to the long-term reduction of inequality. I do think that we shouldn't rely wholly on redistribution through taxes and benefits. I think it's very vulnerable because, you know, as soon as a government comes in that doesn't like so much redistribution, it's so easy for it to just reduce top tax rates and reduce benefit levels. I think the way to get greater equality more deeply embedded in our societies is to, our long-term strategy should be to democratize the economy. You know, democracy is increasingly meaningless, just confined to a narrow political sector as if the rest of economic life didn't make any difference. We've got to have a more fundamentally democratic society. And I think that means not only token representation of employees on company boards, but really substantial representation, and ideally increasing over time. I would like to think eventually the employees would be the majority on company boards. I think we also need incentives. I mean, most countries have some incentives for employee ownership, employee share ownership schemes, all that kind of thing. I think we need to give much bigger incentives to that. And incentives to cooperatives. All those kinds of companies, more democratic models, and there are lots of different kinds of democracy, but they seem all to lead to better economic performance, higher productivity. But I think they're also much nicer places to work. You know, if your boss is paying himself millions and you're getting the basic minimum wage, you're just going to feel used. You're going to go off sick as often as you think you can get away with it. And, you know, only work when you feel you have to, when people are watching you. I think that if you have a more democratic model, it improves relationships with colleagues and so on. So you may feel you're letting down your colleagues if you have sickies and so on. But I think that the fear that if you have decent welfare benefits, that people won't work, part of that is because work is a pretty unpleasant experience for most people. And actually, we can make it something where people get not only a sense of camaraderie amongst people they work with, but also a feeling of self-worth. Mm. And, you know, epidemiology shows actually that even under the present system, work often holds people's lives together in some way. And that unemployment is extraordinarily debilitating. So I think we've got to extend democracy as the main plank for how we deal with inequality. But I don't mean at all that we've got to deal with tax avoidance and tax havens. That means international action, and I still hope we don't get out of the European Union. Because, you know, there's so many problems, like dealing with tax havens, but also global warming and so on, which need international action. And little countries isolated on their own are not going to have any ability to achieve that.
Richard, in terms of the, you know, you were you're a co-founder as well of the Equality Trust. Sort of, how do you see kind of the... How do you progress now? Like, you've done an incredible achievement in the academic work you've done, and he talked about, you know, putting that out there through the books in terms of, and your engagement, public engagement. How, where do you see the kind of core ideas that, you know, more equal societies do better? Where is it at now in terms of the narrative? Like, we had, you know, the Piketty book as well. You know, it seemed that for a couple of years, you know, the ideas of equality were really, there was a growing momentum behind them. Do you still see that momentum? I think there is to a certain extent, but it's, there is challenges, obviously, in terms of the rise of the right in particular. But how do you see the role of the Equality Trust, and how can sort of these ideas be, I suppose, you know, continue to be progressed, do you think?
Well, I think what I was talking about earlier, that long-term decline from sometime in the 1930s until nearly 1980, long-term decline in inequality, there's no doubt at all that it was driven by an enormous social movement, political movement, sustained over a long period of time. The rich are not going to reduce their incomes just because somebody's published a bit of data that suggests that it's bad for the rest of us.
If only it could be so easy.
We've got to make them worried about things. I think he's a political historian, James Scott, says of the Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s that it wasn't the statistics on unemployment that led to redistribution. It was apparently Roosevelt said we must reform in order to preserve. You know, they thought the system was under real threat, that the depression in the 1930s maybe looked like the collapse of capitalism that Marxism had always predicted. I think that you can see it's not only the right, a growth of the right in terms of, you know, electing people like Trump and right-wing leaders in some other places, but you can also see the scale of the kickback, the growth of the opposition, and people like, what's the senator called? The radical woman senator in the United
Cortez.
States. Yes.
AOC.
Yes.
But also Bernie Sanders, saying things that would have been unimaginable a decade or two ago, and are getting a widespread hearing. And I think that, you know, we are beginning to change the debate. And when the left again has programs that people can understand will make a difference to their lives, then I think the voting patterns will change and people will support left groups. And of course, I think in three Scandinavian countries, they've elected socialist leaders recently. Was it in Denmark that just a couple of days ago they elected their youngest prime minister ever, a socialist woman? So I think there is hope, but we've also got to deal with these problems of inequality because you can't move towards sustainability. Environmental sustainability without greater equality. We show the number of studies that show that greater inequality, because it's about status, emphasizes status competition, it increases status competition, it boosts consumerism.
Yeah.
That is one of the big obstacles to moving towards sustainability. And because we all want to consume more and companies want to sell more and they want to maximize their profits, you know, all that's pretty, it's not a good point on which to start out towards sustainability. So I think we have to reduce inequality. It not only reduces consumerism, but it's also, it looks as if companies in more equal societies place a higher priority Environmental agreements and so on. And of course, big companies do have to do something about their carbon emissions, and many of them are starting to, but there must be popular pressure on them to do so. And I think the campaigns have been against BP, the petrol company. We've got to do that with lots of different companies, really embarrass them, make them feel they're going to lose customers and lose their names, and suddenly getting them to pay the living wage through the same kind of tactics.
And do you see that within the climate justice movement and the climate action movement, this idea of a just transition as being a way, as you talk about, you know, to address inequality and, you know, a carbon sort of transition to a more carbon, a carbon neutral society?
Yes, and the rich have a carbon footprint which is 10 times as large as the poor.
Yeah.
And you can't say, you know, we've all got to deal with this problem, but some people are going to be allowed to go on polluting twice as much, 10 times as much as others. You know, that in itself, it just raises the issue of inequality. So for all sorts of reasons to do with our well-being as well as to do with sustainability, we have to tackle inequality.
Mm. Richard, thank you so much for joining us. That was really fantastic, insightful. And thank you so much for your general contribution as an intellect and a campaigner. And it's been amazing. And thank you so much for joining us here on Reboot Republic.
Well, there's no point in doing research unless people like you spread the, make it better known. So thank you for your part.
Not at all. Look, it was really great. Really great. Thanks for your time. I would just want to remind listeners, we do rely on listeners to support this. This is a patron-led podcast. So if you could head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, the price of a cup of coffee helps keep these going. We all have our own bills to pay and lives to get on with. But do help us out. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.